Raindrops keep falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done, sleeping on the job. Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's
hey everybody, welcome to another edition of Straight Talk here on The Voice, 830 AM WEU. It's Nick Lawrence, folks. Always great to be with you. And you know, one of the things I look forward to every week is meeting great guests like the one we have today. Actually, this is a return engagement for our guest. You may have heard of him. We'll get his name out here in a moment. He was with us about 2 years ago. And at that time, he brought out a book called Buddha's Brain. I love that book, love the interview, and I know we're going to like this one today. The name of the book is called Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. Our special guest today is Rick Hansen. Rick, welcome to the show.
Great. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank and I'm you. Excited about talking to you. So what's been going on with you other than the great new book in the last 2 years?
Well, our kids are 2 years older, and so they're young adults now, and I've been traveling a lot of different places. And also, I would say I've gotten a lot of extremely touching and kind and meaningful emails from a variety of people, which, in a funny kind of way, has made me more excited than ever about the power of practice.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that even as the world seems to be, you know, lurching along the edge of a cliff here, so much out of our control, there are still so many things we can do ourselves inside our own minds and in our daily actions, you know, with other people that can gradually make the world a better place and ourselves happier people. And so that, you know, is the power of practice.
So Rick, you're
very interested in.
You're a neuropsychologist, and you're the founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. I love words like that because it just makes just kind of rolls off your lips in the right way. But you have you're in private practice too, aren't you?
Yeah, in the trenches with real people.
Okay.
I just, you know, got a call a little while ago about working with a sixth grade boy who's being bullied. And a little earlier, I was talking with a 42-year-old man about his marriage kind of running out of gas. So, you know, I'm in the real world, real people.
So do you think the work that you've been doing over these years was it the chicken or the egg? In other words, did you get into the work because you thought like this philosophically for a long time and about the brain, or the work that you've been doing has been giving you more insight into writing these books?
I've always been really interested in what makes people deeply, truly happy. And I've always felt there's just way too much unnecessary unhappiness in the world, in families, in couples, in the minds of individual people, in companies, et cetera. And so, I've been involved in psychology one way or another for over 35 years, and I also started meditating 35 years ago. But in the last 10 years, with all the new information from brain science, a lot of those efforts toward happiness and greater functioning for people now have new traction, because we finally understand what's happening inside the black box of the brain. And that then has been my focus the last 10 years.
So let's get this right out there. One of the terms I saw in the book was called experience dependent neuroplasticity. What is that, Rick?
Yeah, one of those phrases that just trips off the tongue, right?
Right.
Well, it's the basic idea that the brain is constantly changing its structure due to experience. And in other words, if we learn something, the brain changes its structure. If we get upset about something, the brain changes its structure. It registers that in that negative experience of, let's say, irritation or loss or hurt or anger or fear in emotional memory systems. On the other hand, if we, for example, put our attention on, you know, small positive experiences and really savor them, there, too, we're going to be changing brain structure. So the question is not, is the brain changing? The brain's constantly changing. The question is it changing for better or worse, and who's doing the changing?
Yeah, and that's interesting because I don't think, well, I guess maybe the traditional thinking up until relatively recently, at least in the world of people who are just lay people, the idea of changing the structure of your brain by your thoughts, I mean, that's a relatively new concept, isn't it? Or is it just relatively new to our finding out about it?
I think it's new and old. It's old in the sense that it's been understood, at least in Western science, for well over a century, that learning had to require some kind of changes in brain structure. All right. In other words, if a kid learns to walk, or we remember what we did, you know, for Thanksgiving or something like that, something has got to change to record that experience or to store that knowledge. You know, what's 2 + 2? Mm. The news is the degree to which the brain can change its structure. And the mechanisms, there are over a dozen mechanisms whereby the brain changes its structure. Maybe one of the most famous ones is summarized in the well-known phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together.
Yeah, I like that line. I saw that in the book. It's great. So let me ask you, Rick, when you talk about structure of the brain, you're talking the physiology of the brain? I mean, are you saying that? I mean, I'm not exactly that word structure. What do you actually mean by structure?
Yeah. So, kind of quick summary, brain's got about 1.1 trillion cells altogether, a lot of cells. They comprise its structure in about 3 pounds. About 10% of them are neurons. Neurons make connections with each other. Average neuron makes about 5,000 connections called synapses with other neurons. Mm-hmm. That gives you about 500 trillion synapses in your brain. That's a network that forms the fundamental structure of this information processing organ. Well, when we're thinking or feeling or hearing or listening, et cetera, the strengths of those synapses changes based on what travels through them. And the strength of different synapses can get, you know, greater or lesser, both temporarily and in lasting ways. So, for example, in just the space of an hour, a sea slug, a pretty darn primitive animal that's learning to get away from a mild but unpleasant electrical shock, will double its synapses in 1 hour. Will build twice as many synapses in the little circuits that connect its sensory organs to, you know, some of its muscles, for example. Or other examples in people, you know, humans, you know, people will build layers of cortex, the outer wrapping, the gray matter of the brain, based on experience. So, for example, London taxicab drivers, you know, at the end of their training, part of the brain called the hippocampus is measurably thicker because they built tissue there. On the other hand, this is the for worse side, people who are routinely stressed usually lose a substantial amount of the volume in that hippocampus because cortisol, a stress hormone, eats away at the neurons in the hippocampus. Wow. So the brain, like I said, is constantly changing. And it's not changing in its gross structure, you know. Mm-hmm. People have two hemispheres, and they have different lobes, and they have an amygdala and a frontal cortex, what have you. Those don't change. But the wiring, you know what I mean?
The
details.
Yeah,
so God is in the details. That's where the devil is too, right? Details of the wiring circuitry of the brain change due to experience over time.
So it's not, and we're not actually then just born. I guess what I was thinking in the past was that you're born with this. This is your potential, and it's limited by whatever your genetics gave you. But you're saying to us, I guess, and maybe if I'm wrong, you correct me here, that you can actually, you're more than what you think you can be, in a sense, as far as developing your brain structure.
Absolutely. There might be an upper limit. Like, for example, you know, genetics, genes kind of set an upper ceiling on raw IQ, let's say, or other kinds of abilities. Like, I'm not particularly gifted musically, but my son is. You know, I could do a lot of training, but I'll never be as talented as he is, you know, at music, for example. On the other hand, when you think about the kind of abilities that people really care about in daily life, in other words, emotional intelligence, social intelligence, or character strengths, character virtues, or what are called the executive functions of being able to plan and organize and kind of exercise self-control, well, the sky's the limit there. And that's where I think we can turn to people who've really made it their life's work to develop themselves in that way, who tend to be found in the contemplative tradition.
Yeah, this stuff
when you study their brains, you see some really remarkable things.
Well, and that's why I'm fascinated about this whole thing. Folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist. You may have heard of him because he's been on my show before, but he's also been all over the place. He's lectured at Stanford and Harvard and a number of other places, University of California, Berkeley. And also, he's been on NPR and the BBC. He's been around the globe, it looks like here. He's been at Oxford. He's a lecturer at Oxford as well. And we're fortunate to have him back on the show today. He's with his brand new book called Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. And while you're listening, I'm going to send you to his website, which is actually easy to remember. It's the name of his other book, Buddha's Brain. So it's BUDDHAS.com. BuddhasBrain.com. BUDDHAS, then brain.com. Why don't you go there while you're listening to the show today? So Rick, this may be a stretch, but maybe you can help me see it this way. If I said to you, change your mind, change your brain, or change your brain, change your mind, is that a legitimate statement? I mean, does it make sense or doesn't it make sense?
It makes sense, and also it's substantiated by tons of research.
Well, tell me a little about that. We have about 2 minutes to break, and I want to make sure I get it all in here. I love talking to you.
Yeah, ditto, by the way. Well, you're exactly right. There are just many, many examples of it. One example that for me is very close to home is that people who just do like an 8-week course in mindfulness, for example, at the end of the training, there's more activation in the left side of the prefrontal cortex, the part just behind the forehead.
Mm-hmm.
There's more activation on the left side than the right side. And that's associated with greater happiness, in part because the left prefrontal cortex puts the brakes on negative emotion. Another study showed that people who, I'll use meditation again because it's a common example, who meditate routinely have thicker cortical layers. In other words, they've built structure, they've built muscle, quote unquote, in two parts of the brain, one that involves controlling attention, the other that's involved in both self-awareness and empathy for the feelings of others.
So, Rick, I'm not sure whether I can be talking to you because you've been meditating for 30 years.
You've got off and on, a certain amount of on.
You've got yourself
a lot of
on. You got a major cortex over there, guy.
One nice thing, too, I'll tell you this really fast, too. Normally, in the regions I just said, normally we lose about 10,000 brain cells a day.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot, but you start with over a trillion, it's not too much. But the people in this study who did meditate and did retain brain, they built up brain tissue in those regions, did not experience what's called normal cortical thinning in those areas, which has a lot of implications for an aging population.
It certainly does. I mean, there's so many things going on, especially now with the baby boomers, as you said, are aging and they're looking to stay young as best as they can. And we have all these evidences of dementia and, Alzheimer's and things like that. I think what you're talking about is really an important thing. Folks, we're talking to Rick Hansen. I already am enjoying this, folks. I just got started. It's the best already. I knew this was going to happen. He's the author of Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. You want to go to his website, which is buddhasbrain.com, BUDDHAS brain.com. I'm only spelling it just in case you would forget that H in there. Anyway, you're listening to Straight Talk here on The Voice, 830 AM WEU. One of the great things about this is you'll be able to go to our website and click on the icon, Straight Talk, and listen to this entire interview again. Take it along with you, download it to your iPod, share it with your friends. We're going to take our first break. We'll be back with more of our guest, Rick Hansen, in just a moment. Stay with us.
Walking down the street, and I start to cry each time we meet. Walk on by, walk on by. Make believe that you don't see the tears, just let me breathe in private. 'Cause each time I see you,
I'll break down and cry. Oh, walk on.
Hey everybody, welcome or welcome back to Straight Talk here on The Voice, 8:30 a.m. WEU. It's Nick Lawrence. Folks, how did I ever get such a wonderful job to do things like we're doing today and interviewing great people like our special guest today, Rick Hansen? My goodness, this is an amazing book. It's called Just One Thing. We'll get into the idea of what just one thing means in a little while here. It's Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. I know Rick's going to share all that stuff with us, but while I have him, no pun intended, I need to pick his brain about philosophical things that have to do with the brain. Now, Rick, we took that last break, and we were talking about the different hemispheres of the brain. What does it mean? People say, you know, I'm more left brain. Another person says, well, no, I'm more right brain. Is that what you're talking about, or is that something different?
Well, that's a... What do you mean?
You know, when
is
people
that
say...
what I'm talking about?
Well,
is that what they're talking...
You're talking about... We were talking about the hemispheres of the brain. Somebody will say, well, no, that guy's... he's more right brain. Therefore,
yeah,
he's more emotional, or if he's more left brain, he's more analytical. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, if I do talk about the hemispheres of the brain, yeah, that I was talking about that part, and I did mention the hemispheres in passing.
Yeah, yeah.
For right-handed people, and probably about half of all lefties, the left hemisphere is specialized for linear sequential processing, which then leads it to be the hemisphere for language, because language is also sequential, as well as the hemisphere for the beat in music, you know, the rhythm section, if you will, of music, and other things that involve that kind of linear, point-by-point, analytical sort of approach. The right hemisphere is specialized for global, gestalt, holistic processing, seeing the whole altogether, and therefore it gets involved in dealing with imagery. And visualization, inner visualization, because an image is a whole thing.
Mm.
Now, for about half of the lefties, this is reversed. Okay, for left-handed people, about half of all left-handed people, this is reversed. But that's the difference. That said, both sides of the brain are very involved in many, many important functions, and I think it's a kind of a cultural meme that has slipped in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're linear and logical and quote-unquote masculine, you must be left-brained.
Right,
if you're,
exactly. Yeah.
You know, spacious and intuitive and artistic and spiritual, you must be right-brained. And, hey, you know, there's a lot of trouble that springs up in the right hemisphere of the brain on the one hand, and actually the left hemisphere is specialized more for positive emotion.
Wow.
So, you know, I think both we need both sides of the brain, right? And almost any kind of meaningful function that served, it draws on both hemispheres.
Yeah, if memory serves me correct, I remember, I don't know, it was in the last year, maybe before that, I saw some type of a study or at least an article reporting that women tend to use, they have a better connection between the hemispheres of their brain. They use them more in combination than men do. Do you know about that? Is that true? I hope.
Yeah, it's a general finding that refers, of course, to the average woman compared to the average man.
Well, of course.
And of course, you know, it's a kind of speaking of philosophy here, it's an unfortunate trick of language that it forces us to put everybody in the same class as if they're all the same when you say men this or when one says men this or women that. But that said, yeah, the average woman seems to have a thicker, it's called a corpus callosum. These are the parts of the brain, it's like a bridge, really, that spans the two different hemispheres and are more willing to, and women tend to be on average, they tend to draw on both hemispheres equal, you know, more than men do. That said, the question, of course, is this innate or is this achieved through the way boys and girls get brought up and socialized? And that's a very murky puzzle that has some pretty, you know, it's a landmine. There's a minefield there that I'm going to stay away from.
Right, but I mean,
I think, obviously, if I could, gender differences about the brain are usually way overstated, including by people who shall be nameless who should know better. And, you know, they're way overstated.
Yeah.
When you talk about the female brain or the male brain, it's so reductionistic because at best we're talking about the average female and the average male brain.
Mm-hmm.
And also we're talking about the average male and average female brain. That's the result largely not of genetics, not of nature, but of nurture, the massive differential socialization that boys and girls, men and women, experience. You know, the differences among female brains are much greater than the differences between the average male and the average female brain. And that's also true for the differences among male brains.
So, I mean, Is that ancestral in a sense? I mean, why would women be, why would their brains connect more, the other hemispheres more than a man does? Is it because of the skills needed in the prehistoric times? I mean, over what men needed, or is it just a difference in nature?
Well, the question, of course, is that based on evolution and genetics, or is it based on culture? Now, you know, in culture, for one, women tend to do and are socialized, and there's much more cultural permission for women to have much more access to their feelings, all right? Well, much emotional processing is carried out in the right hemisphere, so that would tend to build connections based not on biology, but on cultural differences in how men and women are regarded or the kind of permission they get. Also, women tend to be more in touch with their bodies. Men tend to be stoic and numb as far as their bodies are concerned. Much body processing occurs in the right hemisphere of the brain. So you can see both those reasons.
Yeah.
Not based in evolution, not based in what was going down in the Serengeti, you know, back in the day a million years ago, but based on how people are raised and treated and kind of allowed to be in the culture, you could see these neurological differences.
Yeah. Rick, you know this already, but you know how fascinating this stuff is. It's amazing.
I think it's fantastic. It's cool stuff.
It's great.
You know? And I guess if I could just say this,
sure.
You know, 'cause you're a cool guy, I could say this sort of stuff. I think that it's important to be a little careful about how we, you know, in a way talk about the brain these days, because one, as soon as you invoke science, it's the secular religion of the West. It has so much authority,
true.
Right?
That's true, yeah.
You want to sell a used car, put on a white lab coat, you know, and better yet, get a stethoscope as well. I'm telling you, you could sell anything with a white coat and a stethoscope. I mean, that's one thing. And the second is that the brain has this kind of authority, because it sounds like it's really the bottom line in human nature. But it's really important to appreciate that so much of what we think of as human nature is about tendencies and inclinations and capacities, you know, that have a wide range of individual differences, which gives us innately tremendous power ourselves as individuals in a self-reliant kind of way to make changes to our own brain from the inside out over time, you know, and not be swept along by culture, let's say. Including these days, you know, the focus on fear and threat.
Talking about synapses firing, everything that you say, it just evokes some other question to me. You know, in the past, and I know I'm probably maybe 18th century, 17th, 18th century from what I've read, you know, people believe that the heart was the thinking part of who we are. And we have language that expressed all that stuff. Now, I don't know whether the science of the day actually said that, but it seems to be the theme of the day. And now today we're focused on the brain because our science says, well, of course, here's the brain. It's the center of everything that we do. Will there come a day, Rick, when the brain may not be the only thing, maybe cellular brain, each cell with a microbrain and so on? Can you see that happening or not?
Super great question, super smart. You know, for a couple of thoughts about it. One is, are we talking about the heart metaphorically or, you know, literally?
Right, yeah, I know.
And so the metaphorical heart, if you think about it, you know, heartfelt feelings like gratitude or love or kindness or compassion, you know, those are largely constructed inside the nervous system, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about the heart, the experience of the heart, even sensations in the heart, you have a heart attack, let's say, or your heart feels, you feel really open-hearted, or you have a sensation in your toe, you're not having the sensation in the toe. That sensation's being constructed inside your head, you know? So we live in a virtual world, in a sense, and it's poignant and profound in terms of its implications to appreciate the degree to which we never experience reality directly. We live entirely in this constructed world. So we can infer the nature of objective reality, material reality out there, but we'll never contact it directly. So point one. Point two, the literal heart, that said, totally intertwines with the nervous system in lots and lots of complex feedback loops. And there are, of course, neurons in the heart itself. And variations in, you probably know this, variations in the interval beat to beat in the heart rate actually shape our mood, and also can affect the immune system, can make it stronger or weaker, as well as make us more vulnerable to heart attack or heart difficulties. So by doing little things, little practices to affect that that change in the beat-to-beat, you know, variation, you can really affect your mood for the better. So you can see flows then moving from the physical heart into the physical nervous system, you know, that are causal. Also, the nervous system is very intertwined with the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that if you get inflammation, which it releases little chemical messengers called cytokines, which will cross the blood-brain barrier, and some of them can lead to depression.
Unbelievable stuff.
Yeah, it's a two-way street.
Really?
You know, it's, so yeah, so when I say brain, I think you're exactly right. That's such a great point you're making. We don't want to get brainocentric on the one hand.
Brainocentric.
On the other hand, it is kind of the final common pathway for all the causes streaming through us, affecting how we experience and act with others.
Yeah. Rick, I know I'm not going to have enough time with you, so let me just tell everybody, first of all, we're talking to Rick Hansen, folks. If you're just joining us, the name of the book is called Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. In our third segment today, we'll talk to Rick about some of the practices that he is mentioning in the book. There are actually 52 of them that you can use get yourself together. We'll put it that way in the current vernacular. Anyway, while you're listening to the show, why don't you go to his website, which is Buddha's Brain, Buddha's Brain.com. Now, Rick, I don't know whether you meant this or you, but I think as soon as you said it, I wrote it down in my own form. The body is a virtual world, Rick.
Right.
I mean, that is an amazing statement, don't you think? I don't think of my body as a virtual world. I think of it as a real world, but I understand what you're saying. If I stub my toe, I feel it in my toe, but it's actually in my brain.
Yeah. this can get real, you know, it reminds me of those stoner conversations in college dorms.
You go.
You know, I'm not going to go
speak for
there,
yourself,
but,
Rick.
Yeah, okay, there we go. Yeah, well, I was talking about other people.
Well, of course, yeah.
But anyway, couple things here. So first, is there a material reality independent of us? And you can't prove it ultimately, so there's no sense in trying. That said, I think that the most plausible scenario is that there really is, you know, a moon out there, whether we see it or not. You know, there really is, you know, there really are little molecules of DNA inside our cells, even if we, you know, even if there's, you know, if we don't see them or not. So there you have it. Now the question is, what about conscious experience? And that's where you have to realize that it's completely made up in the brain. The colors, look, when we look out in the world, we're seeing about 1% of the electromagnetic spectrum. 99% we're not registering out there. And then what the brain does, there's no color red out there. There are only frequencies of light.
Mm.
The experience of the color red is constructed, you know, inside the nervous system, in particular in the, you know, optical processing system in the brain. You know, a sensation, a lover's touch, you know, or you bump into a wall and it hurts. There is pressure, right? I think there's a physical wall there, and I think there's a physical toe that smacks into it, you know, and gets stubbed.
Right.
But how does that pressure translate to the experience of pain? Again, totally constructed inside the nervous system. You know, we really do live in a virtual world, and, you know, I have something of a Buddhist background, and it's powerful to appreciate the ways in which that world in which we live is, its nature is to be incredibly transient mm-hmm. and fleeting. All the different components of it tend to be very fleeting, and also what's in that world, that virtual world, is constructed. In other words, it arises dependently. Depends on causes and factors to come into being. And third, its qualities are that it experiences this kind of insubstantial quality. It's kind of foamy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get the transience, the interdependence, and what's called the emptiness, and the kind of the foaminess of experience, initially it can become disorienting. But then if you go deeper into it, wow, it becomes beautifully peaceful and freeing on the one hand, and you start realizing that you've got a lot of responsibility mm-hmm. and power over what it is. And, you know, so that, I think, really is an opening to powerful practice, too.
Well, there's a lot of good stuff here that we need to talk about. I mean, as you were talking, I'm thinking about things that we don't truly understand. We don't really understand what consciousness is. We don't truly understand what perception is and how they're related to each other. We act on things that we perceive to be real, but we don't necessarily, you can't empirically prove it, because you're using the same standards to prove it that you would use To experience it. It's a strange thing. Anyway, we're going to take another break. I just want to let everybody know whom we're talking to. And when we come back, Rick, I want to start talking about some of the practices that are in the book so people can get at what you're trying to get across in the book, because it's an amazing book. Folks, we're talking to Rick Hansen. We'll call him Dr. Rick Hansen. He's a PhD. And the book is called Just One Thing. We'll find out what that one thing is, if it is just one thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. Go to his website, which is buddhasbrain.com, B-U-D-D-H-A-S, no apostrophe, brain.com. Well, by now, if you're just joining us, you don't know this yet, but you are listening to Straight Talk here on The Voice, 830 AM WEEU. And if you're already with us, you know you've been doing this for a long time with me. You've been doing these shows probably for about 10 years, interviewing people like Rick. I mean, just amazing guests from all over in the country and the world, bringing us information we can all use in some form or another. He presents the stuff, it's up to you to take it and use it to your best of your ability for yourself. We're going to take another break. We'll be back after these messages. Please stay with us.
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities of Mother Nature's recipes that bring the bare necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam, I couldn't be fonder of my happy home. The bees are buzzing in the tree to make some honey just for me. When you look under the rocks and plants and take a glance at the fancy ants, then maybe try.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Straight Talk here on The Voice, 830 AM WEEU. If you're just joining us, you don't know how wound I am about this interview. And if you have been with us, you know exactly how I'm feeling about this great interview today, because we really have a fascinating guest and always enjoy talking with him. It's been a couple of years now, though, but thank goodness he's back with us. It's Rick Hansen. And he's a neuropsychologist, and he's the author of that book we interviewed him the last time with, Buddha's Brain. But now he has a brand new book called Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. Rick, the mind has been compared to a muscle, that if you exercise it, or the brain, if you exercise it, it gets stronger, and if you let it go, it atrophies. Is that an accurate analogy, or is that just a makeup?
It's pretty accurate. There's this process called neural Darwinism, in that synapses that are not used, those little connections, you know, between neurons, that synapses that are not used wither away and die, essentially. But synapses that are used routinely get stronger, and then new connections get made, you know, in these neural circuits. So it's not that the brain, you know, withers away like muscles might wither away for someone in the space station up
right
there around the Earth, you know, with zero gravity if they were up there for a really, really, really long time. By the way, a little detail, you probably have noticed that we almost never see video of astronauts immediately after they land on Earth walking off whatever, the space shuttle or you know, the capsule, and that's because they can't walk. You know, when they
don't want us to see that, right?
Yeah, they don't want us to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And also the astronauts probably don't want it to be seen either.
So that really, literally that happens. Their muscles tend to atrophy to a degree where they don't have the same muscle strength they had when they left.
Yeah, it's quite dramatic, particularly if they're up there for a while. But with regard to our brains, it's not extreme or gross like that, but it makes a difference functionally. We've all known people who just get more set in their ways, more rigid, and they're almost impervious to new learning. On the other hand, we know people, my dad, I'm thinking about, he's 93, you know, people into, you know, the golden years, as it were, who are still truly lifelong learners.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into those, some of the practices. And one of the, I know each of the chapters, according to what I've been reading, each of the chapters is actually a practice that you talk about in the book. One of the ones that really fascinated me, you just mentioned your dad, was the one that you called curiosity. And about your dad's trip, I guess you guys were going someplace along the coast, and he notices something that you had driven by 100 times and never even thought about. So tell us a little bit about that, and what is the value of curiosity for keeping us healthy and young of heart, at least, or mind?
Oh, that's very sweet that you pulled that one out.
I like that. It was great.
Yeah, my dad grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, and he always had a fascination with animals, and that led him down a road, became a school teacher, then a field and game a wildlife kind of guy, then a college professor, a zoologist, and he's still alive, you know, he's still endlessly curious.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great things, well, so to set it up for people, what I tried to do was identify 52 of the most powerful, down-to-earth, easy-to-do, simple, yet powerful, like I said, things that people could do in their mind or just as a reflection or a few times a day that would really gradually change the brain for the better. And one of them certainly is curiosity, because when we're curious about things, you know, we don't, you know, it keeps our mind really alive. You know, curiosity, it's like a flirtation almost. It's like reality is flirting with us. You know, you're in a dance and sort of place, a party, someone catches your eye and there's this connection, and you're just drawn to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, curiosity is what helps us be drawn into the world. And when we do that, we're continually building neural structure because, you know, neural structure is turbocharged by what we pay attention to. All right? Neurons that are firing together or wiring together throughout the nervous system, but it's turbocharged for what we give our attention to.
Mm-hmm.
So very often our attention is hijacked by negative themes. And guess what? Those neurons start firing away around negative stuff. On the other hand, if we give our curiosity to things that are more positive or interesting, we're going to be building neural structure. We're going to be sucking that,
yeah,
you know, into the fabric of our brain and ourself in a more positive way.
So, Rick, when you're talking about negative things, what is the effect of what a lot of people do, including me at times and probably most of us to some degree? What is the effect of negative self-talk? I mean, you know, when somebody else criticizes, it's one thing. Criticizes us, but when we criticize ourselves, what's the impact on that brain development, that brain structure?
Well, it's not good for a variety of reasons. One is that it's going to trigger negative emotions, and negative emotions, it's important to appreciate when we're irritated or we feel blue because we're beating ourselves up, or we feel at all anxious, or maybe there's a sense of sadness or loss. The same stress chemistry that evolved to get us away from charging tigers is triggered in us today with all of its pernicious long-term effects. You know, as we evolved, most people were dead by their 30th birthday. The you know, long-term costs of stress were, you know, outweighed a lot by mm-hmm. the short-term benefits. But these days, people want to live longer and live well and live healthy lives and be happy. Then for us, the long-term costs of stress are much greater than the short-term benefits. So that's one thing to appreciate, that when you're doing negative self-talk, you're you know, setting in motion these stressful hormonal surges that have a lot of negative effects. The second thing is you're just deepening the traces. The neurons that fire together wire together, deepening the traces of a negative view about yourself, the world, and the future. And a lot of research has shown that growing negativism there is a real risk factor for both depression and anxiety. Yeah, and I would say one last thing really fast. To me, it's a justice issue. You know, when we are badgering ourselves negatively, very often we're doing so as a result of, you know, messages we got from growing up, from other kids, maybe inside our own family. And so it's bad enough that they did it to us then. You know, shame on us that we're doing it to ourselves today.
So Rick, how can somebody have self-compassion? I know that's part of one of your chapters, be good to yourself. Have self-compassion without letting it roll into becoming self-pity. People don't know how to distinguish between self-pity and self-compassion. I blame a lot of that on traditional religions for creating a lot of guilt in people. But how can someone distinguish between self-pity and self-compassion?
That's a super great question. Self-compassion, compassion, pure and simple, is the wish that a being not suffer, right? Mm-hmm. So you see a picture of a child in need around the world, or you have a dear friend who's in pain these days, or you know someone in your own family has had a loss, whatever. You know, you wish they did not suffer. It's as simple as that. Usually combined with an emotion of sympathetic concern. When we're compassionate to ourselves, we're simply bringing that same quality of goodwill and good wishes to ourselves that we would bring to somebody else. Most experiences of self-compassion last less than a minute. Often they're just a dozen seconds or so.
Wow.
That's all it takes. That's distinct from self-pity, where we just wallow in a sense of victimization and also a sense that, you know, there's nothing we could have done about it. It's interesting that research shows that self-compassion actually makes people more resilient. It actually makes them stronger and more able to go out and take action, you know, to make their own lives better or to make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. The problem is most people have a hard time with self-compassion. That's why in the book, in the practice on self-compassion, I bring in some kind of neurologically informed tricks, in a sense, or methods that light up the neural circuits of compassion in the first place, which then you can bring to bear toward yourself.
Mm-hmm. Rick, in that chapter, build strengths. And see, I think I always like things that make me think in a different way from the way the world usually thinks. You say that we're supposed to aspire without attachment. In other words, I set a goal for myself, but not be attached to it, in a sense. And so that flies in the face of what, let's say, business training does or your sales training. You know, they say you need to be attached to the outcome, and you're saying to be successful, don't be attached to the outcome. How does that ring true? That's such a cool concept.
Oh, well, like most of the practices in the book, it's not original. I mean, lots of people have talked about that, I guess, especially in Buddhism. There's this, you know, appreciation of you know, in the virtual world of our experience that's endlessly changing,
mm-hmm.
that if we try to cling to or hold on to any component of our experience, it will be very frustrating to us because it's always slipping between our fingers, you know. So the art in life, I think, as a guy who's been in business, I've done a lot of rock climbing, I've been in wilderness, raised two kids with my wife, married nearly 30 years. I know about it. You know, I've learned that you need to have grit and determination and old-fashioned virtues of gumption, you know, and stick-to-itiveness. That's important. It's also important, I think, to dream big dreams. I mean, one thing that struck me a lot when I was doing business consulting is that, you know, it probably takes about 10% more effort or focus to produce a spectacular result than a decent one. And the problem is most people just settle for a decent one, and they lose faith in themselves, and they lose heart in terms of dreaming a bigger dream.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a really important place there for aspiration in that sense. On the other hand, how do we dream those big dreams and have ambitions and have aspirations and have values for social justice, for example? How do we do those things without tipping into the pitfalls, the pit of snakes, you know, of getting attached to an outcome so that if we don't get it, we get in trouble? How do we aspire without getting driven, without feeling these inner musts and shoulds and have-tos, right? So that's what that particular practice is about,
yeah.
A variety of ways to do that.
You kind of alluded to this idea, but, you know, what I get from when I talk with you is that you present all these great ideas. You've done the research. You think about these things. This book is probably truly a manifestation of who you are as a person. But it's not enough just to know these things, is it, Rick? I mean, somebody has to put this. That's why it's called putting them into practice. People have to do this stuff. I mean, it's nice to talk about it, but if you don't put it into practice, what's the benefit in a sense? So give us your final take. We just have about a minute or so.
Yeah, final take, honestly, is that you don't have to be the Dalai Lama. You don't have to be Christian saint. You don't have to be some kind of superstar to do, you know, to take a handful of minutes every day on your own behalf, doing little things inside your own mind that are skillful. That's what I tried to do in the book, that are specific and skillful, little things
mm-hmm.
that will gradually change your brain for the better. And I think that's a wonderful thing to feel that you have, particularly in a time these days, socially, economically, and politically, when it feels like there's so many forces that are outside our control.
So just one thing, Rick, means doing one thing.
Yeah.
Step and then go to another when you build.
Yeah, one thing today or one thing this week. You know, I put 52 practices in because that's one way to do it, just for the year. Just pick one a week and just kind of have it be in the back of your mind, percolating away. Some of them won't speak to you. Hopefully, some of them will. And if we engage the power of practice, we make ourselves happier and we can make this world a better place.
That's great. Rick, you know what? You're an amazing guest. I appreciate you being part of the show. Stay on the line. I'll be right back with you, okay? Thank you. Folks, Rick Hansen, I mean, I could talk to that guy for hours. You know that. You can tell that already just by my enthusiasm, but more so his enthusiasm because he's done the work. He believes in what he does. Find out more about Rick Hansen. Go to his website, buddhasbrain.com, buddhasbrain.com. Get a copy of this cool little book. You'll be able to read it because it's almost like a pocket-type book. Just One Thing, Developing a Buddha Brain. One simple practice at a time. This is Nick Lawrence, folks. Always love being with you. Thanks for being here. Hopefully you've gotten something good from today's show. I know you have. We'll do it again the next time. This is Nick Lawrence. I'll see you on the radio.
Then we give all we meant to be kind. And if only fools are kind, then I guess it is wise to be cruel. And if life belongs only to the strong,